History shows again and again how nature points up the folly of man. Godzilla. You know, we haven't talked about Godzilla much. And there is, of course, the American Godzilla version, too, not just the Japanese, which would also fit nicely. In Monsters in America, our historical obsession with the hideous and the haunting. Dr. W. Scott Poole will take your calls coming up. And when we do, too, we'll address your favorite monster. If there's a favorite monster you want to talk about, and what your favorite American monster, we'll limit it to that. We'd love to have you join the conversation coming up here on Coast to Coast. Now, I just want to say, just before the top of the hour, you heard Frankenstein. We played that from the Edgar Winter Group. And we just played it as kind of like a bumper into the top of the hour. But there was in the news, there was a death pertaining to Frankenstein. Not the original, of course, movie version or that, but the song by the Edgar Winter Group. There were, you know, some Rick Derringer is most commonly associated with Frankenstein, and he was one of the most notable members of the group. But there were others, and there was one in particular who just died. And I want to tell you about that coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, all the lines are taken right now. We'll try and get you one in just a second. Going back a little bit to say, Ronnie Montrose was a hard rock guitarist, known for being a solo artist or leading his own band, but he was one of the contributors to the Edgar Winter Group. And he died this week at age 64. Kind of a sad story at the end, as I understand it. But he'll live on in his contributions to great rock songs like Frankenstein, which we played just before the top of the hour. And that's what I also promised you, a look ahead. And that's coming up on Easter. I don't know if it's confirmed yet, but we're looking forward to, at some point, if not Easter, right around that time, a new book out by theologian Bart Ehrman. You know him as a frequent guest here on Coast to Coast. And he has a new book out attempts to prove the existence of Jesus outside of the world of faith. It's an argument called, Did Jesus Exist? And this is his amazing attempt at proving to people who believe that there was no real Jesus, that there was, in fact, a historical argument that can be made for the existence of Jesus beyond the argument of faith. And that'll be coming up, I think. I don't want to jinx it, but I think on Easter next time I'm on. Let's go and grab a bunch of calls. We've got everybody standing by for Dr. Scott Poole, Monsters in America. Let's pick it up with Cora, who's in New Mexico on Coast to Coast. Cora?
Yes, I was wondering if you would consider the fact that the more a society is either repressed or oppressed as a factor in how bad the demons are and their reaction to them. And even in the case of body image and zombies, isn't that our pushback on Madison Avenue, expecting us to appear in the image they want us to present?
Scott?
Yeah, I don't know if it's so much a pushback as it is kind of a way to reflect on what that means. Zombies, as we were talking about earlier, they are these rotting versions of ourselves. And I think that that's as much a reflection on our own mortality as a response to, rather than simply a response to corporate structures and advertising and that kind of thing. In terms of the relationship between monsters and sort of, repressed natures of fear in society, you know, I think that monsters have been frequently a way to kind of let the tiger out of the cage, to kind of explore some of those repressed areas of ourselves. And certainly if you look at the history of the horror film in America, there's been all of these moments when the horror movie was sort of the one place there could be kind of an open airing of some of these issues. I think actually Frankenstein is a good example, because James Whale's version, you know, taking place at a time when there was all this discussion about criminality, the popularity of the freak shows, all that sort of stuff, there's an opportunity to kind of pull back from that and say, well, wait a minute. Is the monster partially sympathetic? In what ways is the monster like us? what does it mean that we're so quick to become angry villagers and to sort of go out and hunt the monster? So I don't think it's a simple sort of hydraulic model in the sense of, you know, the more we sort of repress, the more the monsters come out.
Well, I was just wondering, in the case of the Pilgrims, that was certainly a repressed society, and they were facing the extra danger of living in an unknown land, mm-hmm. not knowing if they were going to survive, like, the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a way of their not facing up to their repression and the effect of, you know, mortality, basically.
I think it's a good point.
I mean, you're absolutely right that, I mean, the Puritans found themselves or thought that they were sort of surrounded by threats on every side. I think it's also interesting with them that so many of their threats came from within in their perspective. I mean, their fear of witches and also Quakers, actually,
right.
Was kind of this fear of this kind of fifth column from within. Although it is really important to keep in mind that, you know, it was not a simple fear reaction. They had a whole theological structure that went along with that and that they had brought with them and that was part of the reason why they read their world in that way.
I saw Roger Brown sent me a tweet on this. Thank you, at Deacon Punnett. He said, horror movies have the monster attack couples who are making out, he said, because this represents the jealousy of the outcast. That's also a fair point, I have to say. All right, let's go to Max in Toluca Lake, California, on Coast to Coast for Scott Poole, Monsters in America. Max?
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Good, how about you?
Hey, Max.
I'm doing pretty good. I heard you make a comment earlier that you believe that Big Feet or Bigfoot or Sasquatch were actually not trans-dimensional or pan-dimensional beings.
I've heard the argument that they are interdimensional or pan-dimensional beings. I just find that less convincing than them having an actual corporeal existence.
Well, yeah, it's easy to say that without seeing it, but I've actually seen, when I was 7.5, I saw one materialize in front of me.
I can't dispute what you saw. I understand that.
Yeah, it appeared to me, I guess, kind of like a shadow person, I guess. It was stalking the woods. It was in the middle of the night. I was at a day camp, and we had a sleepover. I was with a couple of friends that were away from the rest of the, you know, the kids and whatnot at night, of course. You know, we weren't
just sure.
That.
Okay.
The other side of it.
I trust your account. I mean, I'm not disputing that that's what you saw. I just, in terms of it of fitting into a worldview, I won't take anything away from what you experienced. And I think that, I hope that's something that you maintain to your death. But I just, you know, for me, I'm just not sure in the end that that's how that's going to play out. Whether that is something else you saw that then you also attribute to being Bigfoot, I'm okay with that too. I just couldn't tell you for sure. I just can only tell you how I think of it. Let me just get to a Gene who's in, you know, let me get to Allison. Okay, because she wants to talk about her favorite monster.
Hello.
In America. Hey, Allison.
I don't think you've mentioned him yet, but the creature from the Black Lagoon.
Oh, I was hoping somebody would bring him up.
I just love him.
That's actually one of my favorites, too. And, of course, you know, he was sort of late in the Universal Studios cycle. He's actually a creature of the 50s and is sort of a lot more like the creature features in that way. It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, goes back to, I think, to our earlier discussion about monsters and sexuality, because there's sort of this King Kong theme with the creature from the Black Lagoon. He becomes very attached.
Oh, I know. Yeah, with Julie Adams, the actress.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
And except it's more believable in a way because they're about the same size and everything, too, you know.
Right, right. And so, you know, I think that's one of the things that's very interesting about that, you know, even thinking about sort of the otherness of the creature. I mean, you know, he's this walking fish, right? And,
right.
And this is a very beautiful sort of ideal version of post-World War II American womanhood. I mean, that really, you know, it really touched on notions of sexual threat and kind of the idea of, you know, the sort of white women in danger theme, which is something that I talk about in the book, is kind of a sub-theme running through American history. And yet at the same time, you know, he's sort of threatening and predatory, and yet He's a deeply sympathetic monster, in many ways more sympathetic than Frankenstein, almost kind of embodies endangered nature in certain kinds of ways. He just wanted to be left alone in his lagoon, right?
Yeah, what I like about the poster, the movie poster always shows the creature from the Black Lagoon holding the actress. What did you say? Her name was Julia Adams. And always holding her and always looking like he's just about to cop a feel. The hand right. is coming up
which,
right around.
Know, actually, with horror film posters in the 1950s was a pretty common theme. Some of the more famous ones like the Michael Landon, I Was a Teenage Werewolf, it definitely has sort of the, you know, the werewolf as sexual threat. Even some of the Alien Invasion.
Well, it's just even in the poster, just to see the hand going for second base on the
yep.
poster for the Black Lagoon, it's,
yep.
it couldn't get more obvious than that. Gene, west of the Rockies in Phoenix on Coast to Coast for Dr. Scott Poole. Go ahead, Gene.
Good evening. Hey, first of all, I'm a registered nurse. I married into the tribe, Navajo tribe, probably about 30 years ago. I lived up on the reservation.
Uh-huh.
I recently have been, you know, I mean, I've seen them before. Myself, but recently there's been an increase in the sightings up there, not only by the Navajo police, but one supposedly got hit on I-40 about 2 months ago by a semi, and they couldn't find the body afterwards. But what I'm talking about is skinwalkers. Now, I know how to begin. I've had medicine men tell me, you know, in the family how to become one, and I've actually seen them firsthand out there in the woods at night. But, Doctor, this is something real. I mean, and it's just not just the skinwalkers up there. Of course, all the lights and activity that's been going up there is just going nuts. But this is documented by the Navajo police. They out in Crown Point, they just did a series on what happened, and one got hit on I-40. They couldn't find the body. A semi hit it.
Right. So let's talk about that in terms of monsters in America, though, Gene.
Right.
So go ahead. You had a point you wanted to make or a question?
Well, no, you know, I have a question. What does the doctor, you know, doctor, what do you think about, you know, actual real monsters? I mean, this is something that's been documented.
Okay.
The Navajo referred to as Chingy. I mean, what do you think?
Again, I would go back to our earlier discussion. I mean, I don't think until there is empirical evidence for something, and eyewitness accounts, you know, unfortunately, don't count as empirical evidence. I tend to be more interested in how those kinds of beliefs have functioned and why it is that they're important to people. I think the skinwalker belief is especially interesting because not only does it connect back to some of the important traditions of the Navajo, but it also has become kind of entangled in modern American urban legend. The old Route 666, which actually I believe in Utah the type name has been changed, but it was a very common place to sight these sort of werewolf like creatures, and so, you know, I think that they kind of have performed this function of suggesting that there's still something wild out there, that the American frontier is not as closed as we think it is, or maybe as on some level that we really know that it is. But, you know, I'm just not really interested in the question of sort of the reality, the kind of empirical ontological reality that your question suggests. I'm really interested in sort of what those stories mean. And obviously this is a story that means a lot to you and to a lot of people.
Let me go to Paul, who's in the Bronx on Coast to Coast for Dr. Scott Poole. Go ahead, Paul.
Yes, how you doing? How you doing, Ian? How are your guests also? Listen, I want to talk about America's fascination with mechanical monsters.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Hasn't come up yet. Good.
Yeah, that's great, because actually Ian mentioned the Worst Things Waiting chapter in the book, and part of what I do there is I talk about our increasing fears of post-human monsters, really sort of the idea of cybernetic monsters, which kind of began with sort of the killer android idea, and now I think has morphed into, in a way, sort of scarier places.
What are you thinking of, Paul?
Yeah, I'm thinking about specifically monster trucks. I went to a monster truck show about 2 weeks ago in New Jersey, And it was fascinating because they had two specific, well, the first of all, they had the Superstar, which was Grave Digger.
Yeah.
They had two trucks that fascinated me. One was a monster school truck. I mean, a monster school bus. And the other one looked like a giant lobster by the name of Crustacean.
Okay. Well, that sounds interesting. But at the same time, you know, it seems a little off topic. But thanks, Paul. Let me get to John, who's also in the Bronx and is obviously your neighbor. John, you have a quick thought on monsters in America?
Well, I wanted to ask your guest about the relationship between Ed Wood and Bela Lugosi, and mainly, how did Bela Lugosi's real-life heroin addiction affect his depiction of Dracula and, you know, his roles in other films?
Well, I don't know if that's in your wheelhouse, Scott, but I am curious about drugs and monsters in America.
Well, I can actually talk just a little bit about Bela Lugosi, not a lot, but... I will say, actually, you know, sort of the worst period of his heroin addiction was post-Dracula. And so it's actually a lot of the really terrible films that he was making in the 1940s when after he left Universal that you really saw the effects of that. Lugosi is really a depressing story because, you know, he actually gave up the opportunity to play Frankenstein. The reason being that he felt like, you know, he didn't want to be the monster that just sort of walked around and made grunting noises and had no idea that it was going to make Boris Karloff the incredible star and celebrity that he became. So, unfortunately, Lugosi's career declined pretty rapidly after that. As far as sort of the idea of drugs and monsters, I am very interested in the way that the vampire mythology has focused more and more over the last 20 years in the notion of addiction, particularly with some of these brooding vampires that these brooding tormented vampires that we have in pop culture who almost sort of can't seem to help themselves and are always sort of trying to struggle, you know, with their addiction to human blood. And then, you know, that's coming very clearly from, you know, public cultural discourses about addictive behavior.
Yeah, but I think there's another category there that that we are hinting at, which is that for a while it was the crystal meth. It was like babysitters on PCP during that whole period where all these urban legends about that.
Right.
But then even, you know, going back to Reefer Madness and even before that, back to the Victorian era about, you know, drinking a potion and becoming a completely different person in the Jekyll Hyde scenario.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned Reefer Madness because, you know, there's often been a tendency in American culture to connect sort of, you know, poisonous, deadly drugs to the foreign. And to the exotic. I mean, you know, some of the first anti-marijuana laws in the Southwest were really sort of anti-immigrant laws, sort of directed against this sort of fear of Hispanic immigrants and, you know, drugs coming from Mexico. So yeah, I think it's always been a part of sort of our ideas about the other, the dangerous other.
Well, I think there's also a tie-in with zombies. On drugs in America and the rise in popularity in zombies. I think that also intersects there. But we have a half hour left, and we're going to make the most of it. Thank you, Scott Poole, for taking all of our questions about monsters in America. Ryan wants to talk about his favorite monster, and you can too, just to chat about what it means to us. What did the monsters represent? How are we informed by our monsters? Coming up next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Wandering around in the Twilight Zone. That's what we've done all night long. Monsters in America. It's a band called Screaming Blue Messiahs. And I want to be a Flintstone from the, I guess it's from the 80s, right? Like late 80s. Cracks me up. Anyway, I've heard it forever. But the phones are packed. So we'll get to your questions, your comments about monsters in America, including your favorite monster and what you think it means to you. Also, if you missed it in the first hour, I was talking about a story we put up at coasttocoastam.com. There's an interesting werewolf story there, which I want to address with Scott Poole before it's over. And then also a story about two dogs that escaped from their home and went to a pet food store a mile away, went on a big adventure, and it ended up, they knew right where they were going to go, and they let themselves into a pet food store. It was a story done by a friend of mine named Joe Mazin, who's also a big Coastie. So we posted that story up at coasttocoastam.com. You ought to take a look at it. It's a lot of fun. Back to your questions and comments as we wrap up this conversation about monsters amongst us next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Dr. Scott Poole, Roger Wheat treated. My favorite American monster is the Jersey Devil. I'm hearing that from a lot of people.
Wow. Yeah.
But that's a uniquely American monster.
It absolutely is. And it's actually a very old monster. It goes back to an oral tradition in the 1720s and 1730s. So it's been around a long time. Very misogynistic monster story, too. Most of the origin stories of the Jersey Devil have it that he was born out of a witch, or born out of a woman who was unfaithful to her husband, or born from a woman who refused to have more children.
Yep.
So kind of intertwined with some of the misogyny of the witch hunt era.
And now it's intertwined with Snooki.
Absolutely, yeah. I've just made a joke about that. I said something about the Jersey Devil in class the other day, and obviously somebody said, "You mean Snooki?"
Yeah, there you go. Andrew is in Santa Rosa, California, on Coast to Coast for Scott Poole, Monsters in America. Andrew, are you there? Did we lose Andrew? Oh, well, sorry about that. We'll move on, and we'll go to Scott, who's in Columbus, Ohio, Monsters in America. Oh, no, that's Dale. Dale, go ahead.
Hi, Ian. It's great to talk to you.
And to you. You're talking with Scott Poole. Go ahead.
Thank you, Scott, for your information, and it's great to be able to hear from you.
Well, thanks.
I have two stories, if you have time.
Well, we have time for one anyway, because we've got so many other people that want to get on.
Okay, the first one is 6 years ago. My family and I went down to Hockey Hills in Ohio. It's a rural, very rural place in Ohio. And we went down there to ride horseback. We were staying down there for the weekend. We thought we'd take the kids out and have a good time. So we were down there for the weekend, and we were on the horseback, and we were riding through this field, and there was this creature. It was a brown-haired creature that was off to the right-hand side of the trail, and the horses all reared up, all five of the horses reared up, and they wouldn't go any further. So everyone was backing off. The horses were actually backing up on the trail.
What did you think it was, Dale?
Well, it was the Grassman.
The Grassman?
Yeah, it was the Ohio Grassman. It was the Ohio Bigfoot. And that's exactly what we saw.
How close were you then?
No more than 30 yards away.
How big did it appear to you?
It was crouched down when we first saw it. Then it stood up, and it ran kind of catty-corner from the horses. The horses took off. I mean, they backed way up the trail.
Sure. Well, that's very interesting. And Scott, I don't think I read about the Grassman in Monsters in America.
I came across the Grassman either. Although, you know, it has always interested me about the Bigfoot story, that it just sort of how quickly it became trans-regional. So much so that essentially, you know, every region has its Bigfoot now, and I believe there's been discussions about, well, you know, maybe they're migrating and that kind of thing. But it certainly was a monster that captured the public consciousness in a really powerful way. I don't think we actually give enough attention to the kind of media storm that those first sightings in Oregon really set off.
You know, but I think that, I mean, I've talked to people who study the skunk ape out of Florida.
Florida, yeah.
And I think they would make an argument that it may not be the same as Sasquatch, and that because of the Everglades, because of the different environment, that it might be a different type of species. They just haven't been able to get any closer than that. I mean, I don't know that they're all the same. I see the similarities, but let me grab Kinzer, who is in Charleston. Can't be too far away from where you teach. Yeah. Scott Poole, first-time caller line. Go ahead.
I've been watching horror movies since I was really little, like probably a little too young to be watching horror movies.
Yeah, maybe.
Right.
I've always liked Michael Myers and Jason.
Yeah.
And not too long ago, I read this article that said the reason that people are attracted to those types of horror movies, with masks and stuff,
mm-hmm.
is that in kind of a sick, masochistic way, it lets you project your own personal devil or fear.
Yeah.
Onto the mask and
under the white mask, or
yeah, the painted William Shatner mask. Yeah,
yeah. Right.
Yeah, I don't buy that at all. That's an old interpretation of the slasher genre. That, in fact, it's often goes along with the idea that male viewers in particular are kind of acting out their violent fantasies. I mean, some have even go so far as to say this is kind of a counter-revolution against feminism, that these films start to show up in the late 70s, early 80s, and it's sort of men, you know, working out their rage by having these fantasies about killing women. I think that really misreads both sort of the director's intent with these movies. A lot of these directors, like John Carpenter and Halloween, tended to be very progressive, very liberal figures. It also kind of ignores the really important role that women play in these movies. I mean, they're not just victims. In fact, these are some of the films in which you really see the beginnings of the creation of the female action hero. I mean, Laurie Strode in Halloween, this kind of final girl character that is really the one that fights the monster and often kills the monster, at least until the sequel.
You know, I don't know if you know this. You probably do because you're an expert on Monsters in America. But I know you mentioned Todd Browning and the director of Dracula and Freaks.
Right.
And you
and a freak,
Did you know who his uncle was? Todd Browning?
No, Browning's, I don't.
His uncle was the Louisville Slugger, after whom the bat is named. Isn't that cool? Yeah, especially because of the whole bat and Dracula thing that here we have. But his uncle was a professional baseball player in Louisville, and that was his nickname, was the Louisville Slugger, and they started making the bat there, and they gave it that nickname, even though he was a total mess. He was apparently also famous for rounding the bases and falling asleep because he was drunk while he was rounding the bases. Let's go to Adam in Peoria on Coast to Coast for Scott Poole, Monsters in America. Adam?
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment about the current zombie craze.
Yeah.
I think as far as what it means and why it's been out recently, mm-hmm. I think a lot of people are kind of missing the forest for the trees on this one. I think the zombie genre has never been more on the nose than it is right now.
Mm-hmm. Because?
You know, there's a whole generation of people right now dealing with elderly family members that, you know, the body is still there, but the mind is not.
Oh, kind of an Alzheimer's tie-in.
Yeah, exactly, to the point where not too long ago, I believe Pat Robertson or someone like him came out and said that he felt it was morally justified to divorce a spouse with Alzheimer's because they weren't them anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an interesting comment. I hadn't thought about Alzheimer's.
Yeah, it really is. And in fact, some of the really the literary zombie genre, which is sort of a new thing, Colson Whitehead, in fact,
right,
really important literary writer, you know, just recently wrote a zombie novel. And many of these kinds of novels use zombies to think about our relationship with the dead. In fact, and sort of the parts of our own lives that we are in mourning over. So that the zombie becomes kind of this symbol of people that we have lost, people that are literally disconnected in a way.
Right.
And so, yeah, I think that it's worth exploring that. I mean, I think the fact of the matter is that zombies are so popular because they yield so easily to so many
that's good.
Metaphorical interpretations, and they all work in different kinds of ways.
Ryan's talking about Monsters in America in regard to which one's your favorite, Ryan?
Yeah, hi, guys. I'll keep this quick. It was actually Herman Munster on the Munsters. I can't remember. Was it Fred Gwynn who played that, actually?
Yeah.
But I was actually going to ask you real quick. I'll keep this quick for other people to call in. I'm a type 1 diabetic, and when it comes to zombies, my dad always said I'm kind of like a zombie because I take insulin, but if I don't take insulin, I would die. But I'm still alive, but technically I should be dead. I know it's kind of odd.
Oh, no. You know what? That's a really interesting stretch, but I could see that in a way. It's true for anybody. I think that's true for anybody who has a terminal illness, so to speak, that can be whose life can be, you know, perpetuated and maintained at a high quality of life for years. I think that's a really interesting point. I don't know. I hadn't thought about that before. Had you, Scott?
No, I mean, yeah, I think that is interesting. I think it does, again, point to the idea that you know, zombies are sort of this reflection on how we define life. I think that, you know, we are having all sorts of ethical discussions about what that means. And, you know, in so many of the films, this has particularly become an issue in The Walking Dead, but it goes all the way back to Romero's Dawn of the Dead, is this whole issue of sort of the killing of the zombie. Is that okay? Does that dehumanize the humans that are left when they do that?
Right.
What happens when they start enjoying that, which... You know, often zombie fictions look into what happens to human beings in this post-apocalyptic situation. So, you know, it's just a really interesting field for all sorts of ethical reflections, I think.
Or should we think about killing zombies in the same way that we think about killing the bacteria on our kitchen counter? That it's life we're killing with a spray, but it preserves. Another form of life at the same time. Hey, Tyler, was zombies were your favorite monsters in America?
That's correct.
Okay, you had a quick thought on that?
Yeah, I mean, I've been a fan of, you know, like the Romero stuff, you know, the slow, shambling zombie. But there was this movie back, I think it was 2002 or 2004, I can't remember. Danny Boyle directed it. It was called 28 Days Later.
Yeah.
There were zombies in that movie that scared the living daylights out of me because, I mean, I had never personally seen it before, but I literally had this zombie who was not slow, not shambling. You had this thing that was basically at the speed of a track runner.
Right. It was an evolved zombie, so to speak.
Yeah, and they were also, you know, they were the products of medical experimentation. They were the products of a virus. And I actually think... I've actually had some horror fans call me on the fact that in Monsters in America, I say that 28 Days, I describe 28 Days Later as a zombie movie. And what they've said is, you know, that's not quite right. It's actually a film about our fear of disease, which I do think, I mean, with films like Contagion, this even comes up in Rise of Planet of the Apes. I mean, that seems to be one of our new fears, you know, one of the worst things waiting, like we were talking about earlier.
Well, but it's still a zombie movie, just in the same way it would be like saying, well,
they're...
I know, but it'd be like saying The Werewolf is really a film about anti-Semitism. It's true, but it's still a werewolf movie, right?
Well, yeah, I think the distinction they're making is that Romero zombies are very clearly dead. I mean, they are the undead, and what you're really dealing with in 28 Days is human beings who are infected with the rage virus, as it's called.
Right. Let's go to Wayne in Frederick, Maryland on Coast to Coast. Wayne?
Morning.
Hey, you're talking with Scott Poole, Monsters in America.
Yeah, I was curious as to how he felt with the Resident Evil movies, as with the zombie vampire-ish, because the way of corporate America, you know, with
the umbrella corporation,
if that's more along the lines of a newer monster fear.
Yeah, I don't know if it's newer, but I think that is certainly a part of those films. You know, one of the best expressions of this was the Bret Easton Ellis novel American Psycho, which. You know, with the whole Pierce and Pierce mergers and acquisitions, I mean, it's really sort of this this satire takedown of corporate America. There's also one of my favorite writers, one of my favorite horror writers, is a guy named Thomas Ligotti, and Ligotti actually has started writing more and more about sort of the horror of the workplace, the terror in the cubicle sorts of stories. So. And, you know, going back to zombies, there's actually even been this argument. I read an article just the other day that sort of these flash mob zombie walks and,
right.
and parades.
We do a lot of, there's a lot of those in the Twin Cities here.
That's sort of intertwined in certain ways with the Occupy movement. And in fact, you actually even had some Occupy protesters who dressed up like zombies. Had dollar bills falling out of their mouths, and were sort of, you know, saw themselves as satiring corporate America.
Let's go to Paul in Woodland Hills. We're running out of time. We'll try to get everybody on that we can. Hey, Paul.
How you doing, guys? I just want to say Coast to Coast kicks ass, and I want to make a real rapido. My question was to Mr. Scott Poole. Yeah. How do you feel about the connection between Satanism and Mr. David Icke talks about the reptilians and, you know, just the creatures in themselves, like you said, the Black Lagoon earlier, mm-hmm. and, you know, Godzilla. The same thing with Dracula. I see, like, a correlation with the Vatican, you know, the Francis Ford Coppola movie. Mm-hmm. And also another one was the misinterpretation of Hollywood and, you know, how does Hollywood, how do you think?
Okay. Well, let's get, you got a lot there to try to, you got a lot going on there, Paul. Let's try and sort that out real quickly.
Well,
go ahead.
The Satanism connection is interesting because I mean, we haven't talked about Satan yet, but, you know, in some ways, Satan has been America's premier monster. He's also been one monster that lots and lots of Americans have believed in a very literal kind of way over several centuries. And that actually is something that interests me very much, particularly the, you know, what we call the satanic panic of the 70s, 80s, and early 90s, where in many Americans convinced that there was sort of this vast underground conspiracy of Satan,
sure.
much like in early modern Europe. You had many people convinced that the same thing was going on with witches. So, you know, I almost think if I had to pick a monster that has been most influential in American history, I would have to say the devil, in part because, again, it's been a theological belief
sure.
rather than simply a folk belief or a pop culture image.
You know, what's interesting about that, though, too, is what he was hinting at there about the reptilians and that sort of like the movie series V, you know, the
right.
TV series or the miniseries, the idea of that, you know, reptilians taking human form.
Right.
And that is there's something, again, goes back to what we think almost the perfect are the ones who are going to be the ones to mislead us. It's almost like, and I'm not saying this to make a point, you know, but Mitt Romney is such a perfect looking human being that he'd be the last guy you would expect to pull off a skin, you know, and have it be reptilian underneath. And I think that's part of what that tension exists somehow within us as Americans, always wondering what's really underneath the skin. So thank you so much. I hope that you had a good time. I know it was a long night. Do you have to teach in the morning?
I don't actually. Yeah. So I'm not teaching tomorrow. So I'm going home and going to bed.
Well, excellent. Monsters in America, our historical obsession with the hideous and the haunting, really informative on so many levels. And thank you so much for all of your time. And I look forward to revisiting the subject somewhere down the road too. And that's it. Between now and next month, I don't have any more scheduled appearances here on Coast to Coast, but feel free to keep in touch at Deacon Punnett if you're on Twitter. Love to do it that way. And great shows coming up this week, including that 15th anniversary of the Phoenix Lights with George Norrie on Tuesday, I am told. On Coast to Coast, Deus Te Amat, and I do too.